greetings to the guests and the newcomers that we have here today. I'm glad to see some new faces among us. I was looking through my father's autobiography. That's a strange thing to say. I've read it, and I read through it, of course, even while he was going through the rough draft material, and I lived a fair amount of it, at least after he got to the point where I was a surprise in my family. But I was going again through the part where he, through many different failures in his life, had been forced to begin teaching at the request of people up in Oregon because he had experienced a fabulous miracle when my mother was healed as a result of the prayer of the pastor of a church to which a neighbor lady, Mrs. Ora Runcorn, went, and she was a Sabbath keeper. He's written about it, and he talked about it extensively for all the more than 50 years that he lived in the ministry, at least. And having experienced that, and then with her coming up with the idea that the Sabbath was the day we ought to be kept, and I've gone through that too many times to repeat it again here, he was determined he was going to batter that down and knock that out of her mind and to force her to give up that idea. I didn't know until many years later, really, and I'm not sure that he even covered that part of it in the autobiography, that he threatened to divorce her and that my family was about to split up over the Sabbath day question. But as he began trying to prove her wrong, he began an extensive Bible study that took him to the Portland, Oregon Public Library. And as he's related time and again, he began with the concept of whether or not there really is a God, whether the Bible is his word at all. And then, of course, did the Sunday-keeping churches have a leg to stand upon from the standpoint of scriptures to why they kept Sunday? Later on, he wrote a little chapter about how he had to study it out a doctrine at a time. He wasn't going to any church. He wasn't learning it from sitting in somebody's pew somewhere, listening to a sky pilot, as they called him, tell him what the Bible was supposed to say. But instead, he was studying it out, as he said, oftentimes on his knees. Well, in the meantime, it was the Great Depression, and his family was near starving, and he had had about three different defeats that he wrote about in business, the Flash Depression of 1929, and he had been really just right up against it from the standpoint of trying to make any ends meet and earning any money even to feed his family. Well, as he began writing for his own sake, because it was a method that he used in learning the truth as he was wading through the Bible to try to prove what he was reading and trying to disprove what my mother was clinging to, the Sabbath, he was writing it out, longhand. Little did he know later on that he would use some of that as articles, and little did he know that the pastor of the church, which was the Oregon Conference of the Church of God Seventh Day, would invite him later on to conduct a Bible study. Now, what I'm getting at here is something I will call the motives of a prophet. The motives of a prophet. The last thing in the world my father wanted to do with his life, the last thing in the world he ever expected he would be doing, would be preaching, writing, teaching the Bible. He was 100%, as far as he was concerned, a businessman in this world, of this world, adoring the great successful multimillionaires at that time when about 4% of the population had about 90% of its wealth, the great self-made magnates of business and industry and finance in this country, some of whom he had even met, like Studebaker. I think he had seen but not met Henry Ford. He heard Teddy Roosevelt in person. He knew Elbert Hubbard personally. Elbert Hubbard, as you know, died when the Lusitania went down. The Germans torpedoed that ship off the Irish coast, which helped push the United States into World War I. And my father so admired those people with their multi-millions and their lifestyle that that's what he wanted to be like. He wanted to be one with them. And he wrote extensively of how he was beaten down so low that he was at the end of his tether, the end of his rope. He finally just got on his knees and he said, "I am a worthless failure. I'm a hunk of junk. I am worth nothing. I don't know what I'm going to do for my next meal." And gave himself to God and just said, "If you can use me, then I'm willing, but I don't think you're getting any bargain because I don't know what in the world I'm worth." And he wrote about having to really give up and turned to God with all of his heart and began to realize that he had been breaking God's law. He had to give up on the Sabbath. And then he began to learn a lot of other things that were not quite right, the way he had been told as a little boy when he toddled off to church where the Quakers met. The Quakers at that time weren't quaking anymore. It wasn't fashionable. But as you might know, I don't know if you realize that even some of the staid old churches of today, like the Methodists and a lot of the mainstream fundamentalist churches in the United States, began in a charismatic kind of a format. The word Quaker came from the fact that they used to quake. That is, that they would shake and rattle and roll. But we're talking about holy rollers or in a religious service. They would, they had the method where they would, I've read things about literally, well, they say, I don't know if you believe some of the things that you read, but they claim that there were women in the congregations who would have hair down to here, and their heads would be gyrating so rapidly you could literally hear their hair snap. I would think their neck would snap first. But the Quakers were known for being very dignified, very staid, and very unemotional at the time that my father grew up in the Quaker church. Well, as I think back on that time, I think of the time when I wrote my now wife, Shirley, who was then a little girlfriend, and my good buddy and I, David John Hill, who were kind of marking time in Ambassador College while I took 10 hours. I didn't really want a full load, but I did want music. I wanted voice instruction, chorale, and athletics. Well, they forced me to take one Bible class. And that was my father's class, and a lot of the times he would have a stand-in senior or graduate student who would teach it. Well, we were investigating John, the first chapter, and John Hill and I teamed up together, and we wrote an article about who, comma, what was Christ before his human birth as a class project. And John may have written more of it than I did, I don't remember. Imagine my surprise when my father decided to publish that article in the Good News Magazine, as it was called then. And I remember writing to Shirley, and I'll bet she's got the letter somewhere in an old letterbox. She kept all of my letters, which I wish a lot of them she'd thrown away a long time ago. But anyway, someday she might let our grandkids sneak a peek. I don't know. But I told her, I said, I think my dad is trying to rope me into the church. And I said, I don't know if I told her now whether I wrote this or whether I just told her, but I said, the first one that tries to make me a minister, I'm going to deck him on the spot. I'm going to punch him out, because that's the last thing in the world I wanted to do. As I think back on the events that brought me into the church and into the ministry, I have to think about all of those who are desperately trying to do exactly that. And the hundreds that I've run across in my many years, 44 plus now certainly, involved in God's church, and more than that, from the standpoint of my babyhood and growing up listening to my father preach when I was yet a little boy sleeping on the front hardwood bench there in Eugene, Oregon. I have met so many would-be Elijahs, Jeremiahs, Ezekiels, Daniels, and all their other prophets that it could literally make a small community, I should imagine. And very recently on the internet, run across some others. I've been given books and manuscripts, and I've told you about that time and time again. It says in James, the third chapter in the first verse, my brethren, become not many teachers, as it should read. Don't become many of you masters or teachers, knowing that we shall receive the greater condemnation. For in many things we offend all. And then it goes into, if any man offend not in his speech, then he's a pretty good man, because most of us do, even accidentally, all the time. None of God's prophets, as far as I can tell, reading into their lives, volunteered. Only in the field of religion can people arrogate to themselves offices, titles, that they do not deserve and have not earned. They can't do it in the field of medicine, in government, education, in finance, even in sports. You can't tell someone who wanders up to a PGA official on a golf course, I am a professional golfer and I deserve to be in the U.S. Open. Okay, here's a 2-iron, see if you can hit it 220 yards. Well, of course, after about the third whiff, they call the security guards and hustle him off because he couldn't hit a ball if his life depended upon it. So whether you're talking about basketball or golf or any kind of a profession, someone might say, oh, you say that you're a professional mechanic. Well, let's see you repair that BMW. It's got a cracked head gasket. Or you say you're an electronic technician. All right, here are three broken television sets. Get busy and repair them. It doesn't matter what you're talking about. Any profession, an actual profession in which it requires intelligence and training and education and background and experience and so on, people do not deign to attempt to arrogate to themselves some great title and claim to be someone that they are not. They certainly couldn't do it in, for example, finance. Bankers are bankers because they studied economics in high school and college. And they probably did a kind of an internship in a bank as a teller and every other kind of an office. And eventually, as they grew older and they studied the higher economics and global commerce and finance, they became the owner or the manager or the president or vice president, whatever, of a bank. But they have the credentials. Many people have come to me and decided they want to be in the ministry. These men that I want to talk about a little bit, and I want to turn to the first chapter of the book of Ezekiel, were not men who got an idea one day, had a vision, had a dream, and then went to some other person who was already established as the head of a church or a religion, or who was already a leading prophet, and told them about their dream or their calling or their vision, and said, I know that I am special in God's sight. Because the Lord appeared to me the other day, standing at the foot of my bed, he was 36 feet tall, and so on. There was a man that got on national television and claimed that that was exactly the height of the Jesus that appeared to him, and that God was going to take him home. And he begged his followers, please send money, because he didn't want God to take him home. And I found that that was kind of strange, because he was preaching all the time to everybody that that's exactly where they ought to want to go, is to go home to be with the Lord, to go to heaven. He sure didn't want to go at that time. Look at the experience that Ezekiel had. And by the way, as we get into this, some people think was a UFO. Have you heard about the group down in Colombia that disappeared the other day, another doomsday cult? I don't think it made a lot of the major news. I came across it on the internet, but there is quite a group of people, I think, whatever, 100 and some or whatever, down in, I think they're in, not Zaragoza, but anywhere, somewhere in Colombia. And they disappeared in the mountains because they were having a schedule that they were on to meet a UFO, which was going to take them somewhere. And they haven't been heard or seen from or seen since. So some people are wondering if in fact they did meet the UFO. Anyway. Now it came to pass in the 30th year, in the fourth month, in the fifth day of the month, I was among the captives by the river of Kibar. The captives are those of Judah who had been taken away in the Babylonian captivity. I suspect that Kibar or Habor is actually a corruption of Hebrew, and that it was nothing but a refugee camp on the banks of a river. That the heavens were open, and I saw visions of God in the fifth day of the month. Now, what did he do when he saw those visions? He began writing them down, and we have the book of Ezekiel. Bear that in mind, because a little later we're going to come to a part that talks about the attempt by an evil king to destroy what would have been a major section of the Bible. In the fifth day of the month, which was the fifth year of King Jehoiachin's captivity, interesting that when something like this would occur, he would definitely write down the date and the place and the circumstances. He was a captive, where he was, the year of the reign of the king. The word of the Eternal came expressly unto Ezekiel the priest. He was a priest, the son of Buzi in the land of the Chaldeans, by the river Kabur or Kibar, and the hand of the Eternal was there upon him. And I looked, and I won't read all of this because we've been through it before, but there was a great whirlwind, like a great huge cloud. Brightness was about it. There was amber, or like fire, in the middle of it. Out of the likeness came the likeness, or the midst of it came the likeness of four living creatures, verse 5. And everyone looked like a man, but they had four faces. They had four wings. Their feet were straight feet, not like a man's or a woman's that are angled out at about 45 or 90 degrees, rather, but the sole of their feet was like the sole of a calf's foot, so like an oxen. And they sparkled like the color of burnished brass. They had hands of a man under their wings on their four sides, and they looked like men's, lions, oxen, and eagles, as we see in verse 10 and 11. They, everyone, went straight forward, verse 12. Whither the Spirit was to go, they went, and they turned not when they went. As for the likeness of the living creatures, their appearance was like burning coals of fire. It went up and down among the living creatures, like the fire was moving, just like you would look inside a Bessemer oven while a slag is being burnt off of the molten iron. And out of the fire went forth lightning, and the living creatures ran and appeared so rapidly it was like the flash of lightning. Now as I beheld the living creatures, behold one wheel upon the earth by the living creatures with his four faces, each one of them, four of them, had four faces. 16 different visages here. And the appearance of the wheels and their work was like unto the color of a beryl. And they four had one likeness, that is, if you looked at the man's face, you saw men, or the oxen, you saw oxen, or the eagle, you saw eagles, and not all the others, or the lion, you saw the face of a lion. When they went upon their four sides, and they turned not when they went. A bit awkward in his attempt to explain exactly what it was that he saw. And it's caused a lot of people to wonder what in the world it was when the Bible plainly tells them exactly what it was. As for their rings, and that makes people think because they called them flying saucers because all of the sightings. One of these days, by the way, between now maybe and the time that I'm gone, somebody will photograph one of those things by accident when the camera is in focus. But as for their rings, they were so high that they were dreadful. And their rings were full of eyes round about them four. And when the living creatures went, the wheels went by them. And when the living creatures were lifted up from the earth, the wheels were lifted up. Are these gyros? But this is spiritual. It is a spiritual thing. And why would God, as we see, this is the one who became Christ, but it was the one who spoke to Ezekiel and the one who dealt with all the patriarchs, and the one of divine Elohim, who was the God of the Old Testament. Why would he need gyros, which is, in effect, a wheel within a wheel that is spinning, which causes, of course, the gyroscopic action to notice any kind of motion, left, right, up, down, pitch, yaw, forward, or back. When I flew the Falcon many years ago, we had two Collins dry gyro INSs, inertial navigation systems, and there were gyros in both wingtips, in the nose and in the tail. And there was a platform that was established with a computer that was right there on the pedestal between the pilot and the co-pilot. And it would, you could feed into it the latitude and longitude, and you could look on the little chart, it would tell you exactly where you were, even if you're parked in front of a particular hangar on that airfield, and you would put right down within the second, not the minute, of exactly the lat long of where you are. Once the computer was programmed for that and the gyros were all whirring up, the instant you began to taxi, it was clicking off exactly your speed and where you were moving. And the beauty of it is that when you were in the air, and as you know, air moves, and the airplane will move depending upon where the air is coming from. And if you get into a jet stream, say a headwind, and you're quartering into it, you may be, without realizing it, blown many, many miles off course. But the computers were so sensitive, the gyros were so sensitive, they could sense every bit of that. So you could tell instantly where you were, your forward speed over the ground, whatever drift angle there was, exactly how far it was to the waypoint you had programmed into the computer, and what your next waypoint was, and so on. And you could call to center and tell them exactly what the wind was, because it would automatically subtract or add for a tailwind or a headwind. But this is spiritual. And God certainly doesn't need a platform. He doesn't need a great big translucent sea of glass or a table or a throne. But he appeared in this fashion to Ezekiel, and my question is why? This was not a voice that said, Ezekiel, at night. Wasn't a strange sighting. He was able to look at this thing, watch it move, look at all the details of it, and to see it twice, as we see in the 10th chapter. And not only that, but look at the rest that he saw. He describes all of this about the noise of their wings. Verse 24 was like the voice of the Almighty. The voice of speech is the noise of an host. And when they stood, they let down their wings. And there was a voice from the firmament, which merely means expanse, that was over their heads when they stood and let down their wings. And above the firmament that was over their heads was the likeness of a throne. Likeness of. He saw it maybe through all the brilliant, gorgeous colors as the appearance of a sapphire. So it was just like a kind of a light, beautiful blue. And upon the likeness of the throne was the likeness as the appearance of a man. So a shape that had a torso, shoulders, a head, and arms like a man above it. And I saw as the color of amber, as the appearance of fire. Amber is a kind of a golden, translucent, gorgeous, honey-colored substance, which is really a kind of a petrified pitch that comes out of conifer trees and so on. From the appearance of his loins, even upward, and from the appearance of his loins downward, I saw as it were the appearance of fire, and it had brightness round about, as the appearance of the bow that is in the cloud in the day of rain, giving off all of the primary colors. So was the appearance of the brightness round about. This was the appearance of the likeness of the glory of the eternal. I always wondered years ago in college why, when I would read some kind of tract or religious publication, when people said they didn't know what this was, and they would speculate about what it was. They would come up with all kinds of ideas. It's not a UFO, it's an IFO, an identified flying object. And when I saw it, I fell upon my face, and I heard a voice of one that spoke. And he said unto me, Son of man, stand upon your feet, and I will speak unto you. And the Spirit entered into me when he spoke unto me and set me upon my feet, so that I heard him that spake unto me. And he said, Son of man, I send you to the children of Israel, to a rebellious nation that has rebelled against me. He didn't send him to another prophet or to some head of a church organization or to some religious person somewhere and say, tell him what you've seen, or write this down and tell him what you've seen. He said, I send you to the children of Israel. Now, a point that I think needs to be emphasized, because there are some who are starting to teach again against prophecy and against the identity of Israel and against the work of the watchman. This was written approximately 130 years after Israel was taken into captivity. That is the house of Israel, not Judah. He is among the captives of Judah. And this is written about 130 years after they had long since disappeared from history, had been taken into captivity. He said, I send you to the children of Israel. But Ezekiel never got there, because the Israelites were by this time scattered all over the area of Europe and northwestern Europe and the Scandinavian countries and the British Isles, and some of them perhaps still up between the area of the Sea of the Caspian Sea and the steppes of Russia and the Crimean Peninsula. To a rebellious nation that has rebelled against me, they and their fathers have transgressed against me even unto this very day. For they are impudent children and stiff-hearted. I do send you unto them, and you shall say unto them, Thus says the Lord God. Thus says the Lord Eternal. When it uses the capital letters, like L-O-R-D in capitals, that is Y-H-V-H, which means the Eternal. When it uses for God, G-O-D, capital letters, it is the same word, Y-H-V-H. And they, whether they will hear or whether they will forbear for their rebellious house, yet shall they know that there has been a prophet among them. Chapter 3. He was told to eat a roll, verse 2. It was to make his bowels and his belly would be filled with it. It was sweet in his mouth, but apparently bitter once he ingested it. And he was told, verse 4, Son of man, go, get thee unto the house of Israel, and speak with my words unto them. Now, I've never met one of these would-be prophets who had decided that he had been called in the same way that Ezekiel had, or that he had been given a vision or a dream, and suddenly went out and did a work. Just took his vision, or took his dream, took his concept or her of himself or herself, and went out and preached the truth of God to the world as a witness. No, instead, they beat a path to the door of someone they fancy is a religious leader to see if they cannot get recognition, approbation, some kind of credential, some kind of an anointing, so that all the people who are already in a church organization will suddenly be told, aha, guess what? Mr. So-and-so or Mrs. So-and-so has had a great vision, and we are absolutely now convinced that the Lord has sent them, and they're here to come among you and to do this and that. No, that didn't happen in the case of any of the prophets in the Bible, not a single one of them, and none of them were volunteers. He said, you are not sent to a people of a strange speech and of an hard language, but to the house of Israel. Verse 17, Son of man, I have made you a watchman unto the house of Israel. Therefore, hear the word at my mouth and give them warning from me. Unique in all of history. Only one calling was exactly like this one. Ezekiel's calling was unique. It was different from all the others. I want to show you a couple of other examples right quickly. Let's go to Isaiah, the 6th chapter, and show you Isaiah's attitude when he saw something almost similar to this, but he was seeing seraphim. But he was given a vision, as it were, of the throne of God. Chapter 6 and verse 1 of the book of Isaiah. In the year that King Uzziah died, there again, time and place and circumstances, it was the year that Uzziah died. I saw also the Lord sitting upon a throne, high and lifted up, and his train, as it says in a margin, the skirts thereof, almost like the throne, had a trail on it like a comet, filled the temple. Above it stood the seraphims. Each one had six wings. Now, this is different from the cherubim because they had four wings. Each one had six wings. With two of them, he covered his face, which is a sign of humility in the presence of deity. And with twain, he covered his feet. Same comment. That was also a sign of humility. And with twain, he did fly. They were outspread. And one cried into another and said, holy, holy, holy is the Eternal of hosts. The whole earth is full of his glory. These hosts are not human armies. The Eternal of hosts, talking about the host of heaven, all the millions of angels, the 24 elders, the seraphim, the cherubim, and all of the righteous angels who serve and obey God. And the posts of the door, or threshold, as it says in the margin, moved at the voice of him that cried, and the house was filled with smoke. Then I said, woe is me, for I am undone, because I'm a man of unclean lips, and I dwell in the midst of a people of unclean lips. Always when someone, and there are so many cases in the Bible where that is true, we think of what happened when Moses approached the burning bush. Take off your shoes, for where you stand is holy ground. We think of the case of Daniel, who was absolutely so astonished that he couldn't even get up from the ground until the great archangel who visited him came up to him and actually put his hand on his shoulder and said, receive strength and stand up because I want to talk to you. Always there was shock. There was awe. There was tremendous shame and humiliation. There was an awareness or an acknowledgement of their inadequacies, of their sins, of their inability to stand in the presence of God and God's power and righteousness. There was not pride. There was not vanity. There was not eagerness to get up and go tell somebody about this. But it was a, so to speak, soul-shaking experience. He said, I am a person of unclean lips because mine eyes have seen the King, the Eternal of hosts. Now, he didn't see God face to face. Christ tells us that in John 3:13. Then flew one of the seraphims unto me, having a live coal in his hand, which he had taken with the tongs from off the altar. He's seeing this in vision. And he laid it upon my mouth. That would burn it if it were really a live coal, but it was symbolic. And in the vision, lo, this has touched your lips, and your iniquity is taken away, and your sin is purged. Elsewhere, we read of the altar, and of the fires before the altar, and of the incense, and of the prayers of saints, as it is going up to actually fuel the altar before God. And so there is a symbolism here of the coal from the altar being a symbol of redemption, of forgiveness, of wiping away his sins, of making him a vessel who can now go out and fulfill the word of God, the work of God. He laid it upon my mouth and said, lo, this has touched your lips, your iniquity is taken away, and your sin purged. I heard the voice of the Lord saying, whom shall I send and who will go for us? And I said, here I am, send me. He was made willing. He was brought low, brought to repentance. And so he said, behold, I, as it says in the margin. And he said, go and tell this people, hear you indeed. And notice how this is the very same prophecy to Jesus Christ himself related in the 13th chapter of the book of Matthew when he quoted it virtually verbatim. Hear you indeed, but understand not, and see you indeed, but perceive not. Make the heart of this people fat and their ears heavy, and shut their eyes, lest they should see with their eyes, and hear with their ears, and understand with their heart, and convert and be healed. And I said, Lord, how long? He said, in other words, how long will that condition prevail? How long will it be until you will open their ears, open their eyes, and they will see with their mind and their heart and be converted? He said, until the cities be wasted without inhabitant, and the houses without man, and the land be utterly desolate. And the Eternal has removed men far away, and there be a great forsaking in the midst of the land. And yet in it shall be a tenth, and it shall return, and shall be eaten as a teal tree, and as an oak whose substance is in them when they cast their leaves, so the holy seed shall be the substance thereof. A prophecy which seems to strongly imply that after the day of the Lord, a time when there will be cities without inhabitant, the land utterly desolate, everything completely waste, that only a tithe of mankind, and probably that means 10% of the population of the United States and 10% of the population of Britain, of Australia, of Canada, of South Africa, of every nation really, will remain on this earth, and that up to 90% of the population of the world will perish by the time Jesus Christ's feet stand on the Mount of Olives and the millennial reign of Christ begins. Strong implication of that. And you cannot read through all the prophecies beginning in the 9th chapter of Revelation, read through the 13th and through the 17th and 18th and the 19th of the second coming of Christ about all the great trumpet plagues and about the seven last plagues of every green tree smitten, of all the creatures in the sea dead, of the waters, even of the springs and rivulets and creeks and the wells and the oceans and the bays and estuaries turning to blood without understanding that a massive amount of death is going to occur before the time of the second coming of Christ. Here again is the calling of a prophet of God for the purpose of going out and of giving warning and witness to nation after nation after nation. Now, Isaiah was not a world traveler. Neither was Ezekiel. Ezekiel wrote prophecies against Edom, Moab, Ammon, Egypt, Assyria, so on, prophecies against all these other nations, and the entire time, he's writing it down. He's writing it down. He didn't stand up in any pulpit and read it. He didn't reproduce it. Gutenberg hadn't invented the printing press yet. There weren't copies being made and sent with a fast horseman down to Egypt to warn them of what God was telling Ezekiel, but he wrote it. And so did Isaiah. And so that scroll sat there, and it probably went with him until he died and eventually was within the temple and was among those scrolls that were gathered up from those that were recognized as being important for the history of Israel. And eventually, over a long period of time, began to be recognized as a part of the Old Testament canon when it was gathered together by Ezra after the return from Babylonian captivity. Either Ezra and or Nehemiah or Zerubbabel or some one of them or someone delegated by them to carry these precious documents back to Jerusalem after the Babylonian captivity were responsible for these books of the Bible to be retained so that we can read them today. Now let's turn to the book of Jeremiah and look at the 33rd chapter right quickly. Jeremiah 33. Jeremiah actually bought some property even while he was in prison. And Jeremiah, just like, and I think that's fascinating, by the way, I think just like the example of the Apostle Paul, who wrote many of his letters while he was in Roman imprisonment, so Jeremiah wrote some of the most important parts of his book while he was yet in prison. In Jeremiah, the 33rd chapter, we notice that this is the second time that the word of the Eternal came to him while he was yet shut up in the court of the prison, saying, verse 2, "Thus says the Eternal, the maker thereof, the Eternal that formed it to establish it, the Eternal is his name, call unto me, and I will answer you, and show you great and mighty things which you know not. For thus says the Eternal, the God of Israel, concerning the houses of this city, and concerning the houses of the kings of Judah, which are thrown down by the mounts and by the sword, they come to fight with the Chaldeans, but it is to fill them with the dead bodies of men, whom I have slain in mine anger and in my fury, for all whose wickedness I have hid my face from this city. Behold, I will bring it health and cure, and I will cure them, and will reveal unto them the abundance of peace and truth. And I will cause the captivity of Judah and the captivity of Israel to return." That's not merely a repetitive statement. That's not merely redundancy. Israel had gone into captivity long years before Judah ever went into captivity in Babylon. Look at Ezekiel 36 chapter about the rebuilding of the cities of Israel, and Ezekiel 37, which is the prophecy of the valley of dry bones, which is the resurrection of all of physical Israel, if you read the whole thing. "And will build them as at the first, and I will cleanse them from all their iniquity, whereby they have sinned against me. And I will pardon all their iniquities, whereby they have sinned, and whereby they have transgressed against me." Now, skipping ahead a little bit, verse 14, "Behold, the days come, says the Eternal, that I will perform that good thing which I have promised unto the house of Israel and to the house of Judah. In those days and at that time will I cause the branch," capital letter B, the translators knew that they should do that, "of righteousness to grow up unto David, and he shall execute judgment and righteousness in the land," a prophecy of the first and the second coming of Christ. "In those days shall Judah be saved." Has that happened yet? Absolutely not. Look at Romans, the 9th chapter, and Paul's analogy of the grafting in of the wild olive tree, and how all Israel shall be saved, and eventually the prophecy that says Judah and Ephraim will be gathered together to become one stick in his hand. And look at the last third of the 11th chapter of Isaiah, which depicts how that is going to happen, which can only be a picture of what is to happen during the millennial reign of Christ. The Jews to this day do not acknowledge Christ. They have not acknowledged Christ as the Messiah, as they call it, or him, rather, and he is not their Messiah. They are still looking for a Messiah. And, you know, we've told you time and again about Gershon Salomon and the Temple Mount faithful who are still trying to build a temple over there to prepare for Mashiach ben David, as they call him, or the Messiah who is supposed to come, because they rejected Christ. No one can say that the Jews have been saved. And yet, in the 7th chapter of Revelation, when you look at the 144,000, it said that 12,000 of all of the Jews and 12,000 of the Simeonites that we would think of as Jews, and 12,000 of Levi that we certainly would think of as Jews, 36,000 in all of the former house of Israel, of Judah rather, are going to be saved at the time of the heavenly signs. I think it's because they've heard a warning. I think it's because they knew that something like this was going to happen. I think it's because the fruit of the work of God will not really be born until Almighty God Himself intervenes and the great heavenly signs are revealed from heaven above and millions of people are going to fall to their knees. It says there is a great innumerable multitude of all nations, which includes Ephraim, Manasseh, Judah, Levi, etc., and all of those. It can be other Jews in addition, but among the 144,000, there are 12,000 of each one of the three main tribes that were called a part of the house of Judah. "In those days shall Judah be saved, and Jerusalem shall dwell safely." Jerusalem is not a safe place to be today. You go over there as a tourist and you can get yourself killed. You know, every now and then we hear of another bus being blown up or people being assassinated right on the streets. "Jerusalem, though, shall dwell safely, and this is the name wherewith she shall be called, the Eternal, our righteousness," the name of the city itself, God, our righteousness. "For thus says the Eternal, David shall never want a man to sit upon the throne of the house of Israel," a part of the Davidic promise or Davidic covenant. "Neither shall the priests, the Levites, want a man before me to offer burnt offerings and to kindle meat offerings and to do sacrifice continually." He said, if you can break the covenant of the day and the night, verse 20, then you can break that covenant. Now, chapter 34, the word which came from Jeremiah, unto Jeremiah from the Eternal, when Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, and all of his army, and all of his kingdoms of the earth, of his dominion, and all the people, fought against Jerusalem, and against the cities thereof, saying, thus says the Eternal, the God of Israel, go and speak to Zedekiah, the king of Judah, and tell him, thus says the Eternal, I will give this city into the hand of the king of Babylon. He will burn it with fire. You, the king, will not escape out of his hand, but will be captured and delivered. Your eyes will behold the eyes of the king of Babylon. He will speak to you mouth to mouth, and you shall go to Babylon. Yet hear the word of the Eternal, O Zedekiah, king of Judah. Thus says the Eternal of thee, you will not die by the sword, but you will die in peace, and with the burnings of your fathers, the former kings which were before thee, so shall they burn odors or incense for thee. And they will lament you, saying, ah, Lord, for I have pronounced the word, says the Eternal. And then Jeremiah the prophet spake these words unto Zedekiah, king of Judah, in Jerusalem. When the king of Babylon's army, they were besieged now, the king of Babylon is out there completely surrounding them with tens of thousands of soldiers. They're beleaguered, starvation is setting in. It talks about how the cab of a dove's dung sold for a little bit, and they were actually resorting in some cases to cannibalism in the terrible famine that occurred. And against all the cities of Judah that were left, against Lachish and against Azekah, for these defense cities remained to the cities of Judah. This is the word that came unto Jeremiah from the Eternal. After that, the king Zedekiah had made a covenant with the people which were at Jerusalem to proclaim liberty unto them. Lying heads of state, nothing new. The armies were advancing, they're all around, they've taken everything but these other two fortified cities, the whole land is being occupied, and he's proclaiming liberty. We're going to come out of this just fine, don't worry about it. That every man should let his manservant, every man his maidservant, being an Hebrew or an Hebrewess, go free, that none should serve himself of them, to wit, of a Jew, his brother. Now when all the princes and all the people which had entered into the covenant heard that everyone should let his manservant, his maidservant, go free, that none should serve themselves of them anymore, they obeyed and let them go. So he's proclaiming amnesty and freedom for all of them in this time of great duress. And afterward they turned and caused the handmaidens and servants whom they had let go to return, and brought them back into subjection for servants and handmaids. Therefore the word of the Eternal came to Jeremiah from the Eternal, saying, thus says the Eternal, the God of Israel, I made a covenant, and I told you this. Verse 14, at the end of 7 years, you let every man who is your Hebrew brother, who has been sold unto you like an indentured servant, when he has served you 6 years, you let him go free. But your fathers hearken not unto me, nor incline their ear. You are now turned and have done right in my sight in proclaiming liberty. But, verse 16, you turned and polluted my name and caused every man to return, got him right back. You gave him a little bit of a breathing spell and got them right back to return and brought them into subjection to be unto you for servants and handmaids. Therefore, thus says the Eternal, you have not hearkened unto me in proclaiming liberty, every man to his brother and every man to his neighbor and so on. And I, therefore, will make you to be removed into all the kingdoms of the earth. I'm going to skip down a little bit to chapter 35, verse 1. The word which came unto Jeremiah from the Eternal in the days of Jehoiakim, the son of Josiah, king of Judah, saying, go to the house of the Rechabites and speak unto them and bring them unto the house of the Eternal into one of the chambers and give them wine to drink. And so I took Jehazaniah, the son of Jeremiah, the son of Habazaniah, and his brethren and all of his sons and a whole house of the Rechabites, and brought them into the house of the Eternal, under the chamber of the sons of Hanan, the son of Igdaliah, difficult name to pronounce, a man of God, which was by the chamber of the princes, which was above the chamber of Maaseiah, the son of Shalom, the keeper of the door. And I set before the sons of the house of the Rechabites pots full of wine and cups, and said, drink wine. And they said, we will not drink wine. For Jonadab, the son of Rechab, our father, said, you shall drink no wine, neither you nor your sons forever, like a Nazarite vow. Neither shall you build house, nor sow seed, nor plant vineyard, nor have any, but all your days are to live in tents, that you may live many days in the land wherein you are a stranger. You're not to build houses, verse 10, but we have dwelt in tents, and we have obeyed. It came to pass, verse 11, when Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came into the land, you said, we said, come and let us go to Jerusalem for fear of the army of the Chaldeans and for fear of the army of the Syrians. So we dwelt at Jerusalem. Now, skipping on ahead, the word of the Eternal came unto him, and he began writing it on down in chapter 36, verse 1. In the fourth year of Jehoiakim, the son of Josiah, king of Judah, this word came to Jeremiah, saying, take your roll of a book and write all the words that I have spoken unto you against Israel and against Judah and against all the nations. And there are many other nations who have prophecies written against them in the book of Isaiah. From the day that I spoke unto you, from the days of Josiah, even unto now, everything, write it down. Keep a record of everything, like a really lengthy diary. Why? Verse 3, it may be that the house of Judah will hear all the evil which I propose to do unto them, that they may return every man from his evil way, that I may forgive their iniquity and their sin. The purpose of it then was to use the witness and the warning so that they would repent and avoid it. Now, in all of history, there's only been one time where that worked. There's no case that I know of other than Nineveh, the capital of Assyria, a pagan Gentile people. At the preaching of Jonah, where an entire nation, like a city-state of people, because the king set them in the example, where they heard a messenger of God telling them exactly what was going to happen, and they repented, and God then caused it not to happen. He simply changed what was prophesied to happen to the city and did not destroy it. And that frustrated, as you know, old Jonah so bad that he sat up there and complained about it, and God had to rebuke him, and we really don't know what his final response was. So the motive was always that they will listen and they will turn from their evil way and turn to God's way and repent. Then Jeremiah called Baruch, who was his scribe, the son of Neriah. And Baruch wrote from the mouth of Jeremiah, at dictation, all the words of the Eternal which he had spoken unto him upon a roll of a book, like a scroll. And Jeremiah said, I am shut up, I cannot go into the house of the Eternal, therefore you go and read in the roll which you have written from my mouth, the words of the Eternal in the ears of the people in the Eternal's house upon the fast day, that would have been, of course, the Day of Atonement, and also you shall read them in the ears of all Judah that come out of their cities. It may be they will present their supplication before the Eternal and will return everyone from his evil way, for great is the anger and the fury that the Eternal has pronounced against this people. So Baruch did so. And it said in verse 9 that in the fifth year of Jehoiakim, the son of Josiah, the king of Judah, in the ninth month, they proclaimed a fast, and all the people came down there to the cities of Judah, and Baruch read the book, or the words of Jeremiah, some of the very material we've been going through. Some of the book of Jeremiah, of what was going to happen to the king, what was going to happen to the cities. They're going to be completely wasted, without inhabitant. They're going to be sent into captivity into the farthest country, to a foreign nation whose language they didn't understand. Then read Baruch in the book the words of Jeremiah in the house of the Eternal in the chamber of Gemariah, the son of Shaphan, the scribe, in the higher court at the entry of the new gate of the Eternal's house in the ears of all the people. Now, it comes very quickly to the attention of the nobles and those in power in the community. When Micaiah, the son of Gemariah, heard the words, he went down to the king's house, to the scribe's chamber, and here were the princes, Elishama, the scribe, and Delaiah, the son of Shemaiah, and all of the rest of them. I won't read them all. And Micaiah declared unto them the words that he had heard, verse 13, and Baruch read the book in the ears of the people. So the princes sent Jehudi, and he said, take in your hand the roll where you have read in the ears of the people and come with me. So Baruch did and followed him. And they said, sit down and now read it in our ears. So now it's gone up to the level of the princes of the community, of the nation. So Baruch read it in their ears, verse 15. Now it came to pass when they had heard all the words, they were afraid, both one and the other, because of the dire consequences and the predictions. And said unto Baruch, we will surely tell the king all of these words. Do you think that this was something that God had not intended? Or do you think that this was exactly what God had intended, just like Paul's capture in Jerusalem, his appearance before Agrippa, and his appeal to Caesar, to actually go before Caesar Nero and give his testimony? They asked Baruch, saying, now tell us, how did you write all these words at his mouth? What a stupid question. Baruch answered them, he pronounced all these words unto me with his mouth, and I wrote them with ink in the book. You know, that's really like a first grade question there, really stupid of them. Then the princess said, you go hide, you and Jeremiah, and let no man know where you are. And they went into the king of the court, they laid up the roll in the chamber of Elisha and the scribe, and told all the words in the king's ear. So they told all that had been happening. They'd been reading it out there in the court of the temple. All the people had been hearing it. Then the nobles heard it and the princes. So the king sent Jehudi to fetch the roll. He took it out of Elisha the scribe's chamber, and Jehudi stood there and read it in the ears of the king. Now this was in apparently a winter palace. Yeah, it was a winter palace in the ninth month. And there was a huge big fire burning there in this great big stone building. Jehudi reads it. The king sits in a winter house in the ninth month. There's a fire on the hearth burning before him. And it came to pass when Jehudi had read three or four leaves, that is, it is rolling down at his feet, and they can see the places where one chapter or another, or there's a break in it or whatever. And so as it is being unrolled from the scroll, not turned in pages of book like we would read, he reached out with his penknife and cut it and would throw it into the fire. So here Jehudi reading the words of God given to Jeremiah, and as it is rolling down at his feet right next to the king, he's standing next to the king grabs the bottom of the scroll and cuts it off, throws it into the fire. There's nobody there who's going to tell him he can't. And so they were not afraid, nor rent their garments, neither the king nor any of his servants that heard all these words. Nevertheless, Elnathan and Deliah and Gemariah had made intercession to the king that he would not burn the roll, but he wouldn't hear them. The king commanded all these other people, and read their names there, to take Baruch the scribe and Jeremiah the prophet, but the Eternal hid them. So now he's wanting to arrest them and bring them in and do something terrible to them. The word of the Eternal came to Jeremiah after that the king had burnt the roll. Maybe all of the book of Jeremiah, including what? Well, certainly not including this chapter, right? This chapter wasn't cut with a penknife and so on. No, it was written later. It had to have been. Otherwise, it would have been destroyed. And he didn't predict every one of these little details, so notice. Take thee again yet another roll, and write in it all the former words which were in the first roll, which Jehoiakim the king of Judah has burned. And you shall say to Jehoiakim king of Judah, thus says the Eternal, why have you burned this roll, saying, why have you written therein, saying, the king of Babylon shall certainly come and destroy this land and cause to cease from thence man and beast? Well, the roll explained why. It was because of the ways of life of the citizenry and of the king and the nobility themselves, the government itself. Therefore, thus says the Eternal of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, he shall have none to sit upon the throne of David, and his dead body shall be cast out in the day to the heat and in the night to the frost. And I will punish him and his seed and his servants for their iniquity, and will bring upon them, upon the inhabitants of Jerusalem, upon the men of Judah, all the evil that I have pronounced against them. But they wouldn't listen. So Jeremiah took another roll, gave it to Baruch the scribe, the son of Neriah, who wrote therein from the mouth of Jeremiah all the words of the book which Jehoiakim, the king of Judah, had burned in the fire. And there were added besides unto them many like words. So we are reading, and we are in possession of, Jeremiah 2, aren't we? We don't have Jeremiah 1. This is Jeremiah 2. Because this is the rewrite, exactly all the preliminary material that we read up to the point where the king was cutting up the scroll and throwing it in, and from here on, all the rest of it was added even afterward. So God made sure that his word that he gave his prophet was not destroyed and that it was fulfilled exactly as he had proclaimed. Now, chapter 37, King Zedekiah reigned in the place of the son of Josiah reigned instead of Coniah, the son of Jehoiakim, whom Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, made king of the land of Judah. Neither he, nor his servants, nor the people of the land did hearken to the words of the Eternal, which he spoke by the prophet Jeremiah. They just couldn't believe it. People in the United States of America today do not believe that we will ever fall. They just cannot conceive of a time when the United States of America will not be here, when it won't be prosperous, when it won't be wonderful, when it won't be liberal, where it will not be a giant melting pot of all races, of all creeds, of all religions, of all colors, of all different kinds of groups like gays and lesbians and all of them just living happily together. I didn't realize that there was such a thing as a massive amount of information on the internet about gays and lesbians until this morning. And I was surfing through Lifestyles, and I looked at Lifestyles, first time I'd ever clicked on that button that comes up on AOL, and there was a subtitle, Gay and Lesbians. I clicked on that, and they've got magazines and music and rallies. They've got schedules. They've got all kinds of businesses. There are lists of gay businesses there and all kinds of things that are there for them to do. It's almost like they are a majority when you read that. It was utterly astonishing to find out that, what is it about, they claim 4% of the population? Well, there was one book written many years ago that said every sixth man. I really don't believe that, but it is very much more prevalent than we tend to think. All right. Now, let's go on. Then Pharaoh's army, verse 5, was come forth out of Egypt, and when the Chaldeans that besieged Jerusalem heard tidings of them, they departed from Jerusalem. Then came the word of the Eternal unto the prophet Jeremiah, saying, Thus says the Eternal God of Israel, Thus shall you say to the king of Judah, that sent you unto me to inquire of me, Behold, Pharaoh's army which has come forth to help you shall return to Egypt into their own land. And the Chaldeans shall come again and fight against this city, and take it and burn it with fire. Thus says the Eternal, Don't kid yourselves, deceive not yourselves, saying, The Chaldeans will surely depart from us, for they shall not depart. Now this I would apply to our country as well, because I know exactly what God has in store for this land. For though you had smitten the whole army of the Chaldeans that fight against you, and there remain but wounded men among them, yet should they rise up every man in his tent and burn this city with fire. And it came to pass that when the army of the Chaldeans was broken up from Jerusalem for fear of Pharaoh's army, then Jeremiah went forth out of Jerusalem to go to the land of Benjamin to separate himself thence in the midst of the people. When he was in the gate of Benjamin, a captain of the ward was there whose name was Arijah, the son of Shelemiah, and it gives their genealogy. And he took Jeremiah the prophet and said, You are a traitor. You are falling away to the Chaldeans. And then said Jeremiah, It is false. I do not fall away to the Chaldeans. But they wouldn't listen to him, so Arijah took him and brought him to the princes. He's under arrest now as being an enemy of his country, as being a subversive, as being completely and totally unpatriotic, and worse than that, being a traitor. Because he pronounced it was going to happen, and now it is happening, they make him out to be a traitor. Wherefore the princes were wroth with Jeremiah and began beating on him, began whacking him up alongside the head, smacking him in the jaw, and hitting him in the face, and put him in prison in the house of Jonathan the scribe, for they had made that the prison. Apparently it was a big, substantial house where they could close it up. When Jeremiah was entered into the dungeon and into the cells, as it should read, and Jeremiah had remained there many days, then Zedekiah the king sent. Now it shows that Zedekiah wasn't completely in charge either, because there was an awful lot of intrigue. There were a lot of the princes who were really influencing him and having a lot of control. The king asked him secretly and said, Is there any word from the Eternal? What do you hear from God? Have you got any news to give me? What's happening? And Jeremiah said, There is, for, saith he, you will be delivered into the hand of the king of Babylon. Moreover, Jeremiah said unto Zedekiah, What have I offended against you, that is personally, or against your servants, or against this people, that you put me in prison? Where are now your prophets, which prophesied unto you, saying, The king of Babylon shall not come against you, nor against this land? That touches a nerve in my mind. Where are the mainstream fundamentalist prophets who wrote the best-selling books, who preached for decades during the Cold War that Russia would attack Israel and that Russia is the beast, when in fact, during all that time, my father before me and I were saying that a Germany at the head of the United States of Europe is going to be the beast power of Revelation 17, and Russia will not attack Jerusalem and is not the beast power. Where are they now? Where are those who claimed that the rapture was going to occur in 1998? Well, I guess they revised it. Maybe they're writing new books now, but they are gone as well. Therefore, hear now, I pray thee, O my Lord the King, let my supplication, I pray thee, be accepted before thee, that you cause me not to return to the house of Jonathan the scribe, lest I die there. So Zedekiah thought that he would save Jeremiah's life, and look what he did to him. Put him in the court of the prison. Well, it wasn't him that was responsible directly, perhaps, and they gave him bread and water. Then Shephatiah the son of Mattan, and Gedaliah the son of Pashur, and Jukal the son of Shelemiah, and Pashur the son of Malchiah heard the words of Jeremiah of what he had spoken to the people, and said, verse 2, he that remains in his city shall die by the sword, by the famine, and by the pestilence. And he that goes forth to the Chaldeans shall live, for he shall have his life for a prey, and shall live. If they would surrender, if they would simply go forth, surrender, allow themselves to be taken captive, they would survive. And we know that Gedaliah and a group and Jeremiah and the daughter of Zedekiah went to Egypt a little later on, but guess who let them go? Thus says the Eternal, this city shall be given into the hand of the king of Babylon's army, which will take it. Therefore the princes said to the king, we beseech you, let this man be put to death. You've heard about the messenger bearing evil tidings is oftentimes slain, because the great king or the great Caesar or someone doesn't like what he said. And so they do away with him, as if that does away with the evil message that is going to come. Sometimes people pay no attention to the message and focus way too much on the messenger. So the kings, the princes rather, said, let this man be put to death, because he weakens the hands of the men of war that remain in this city, and the hands of all the people in speaking such words unto them, for this man seeketh not the welfare of this people, but the hurt. And what was it originally they said, remember? It may be that they will hear what I propose to do unto them, and they will repent and turn from their evil ways and live. What were his real motives? First of all, Jeremiah was about the only patriot that really remained, because the real best possible consequences for his people, the good of his people, the future of his people, was what was in his heart. That was what was in God's mind, the best for them, not the worst. But he is called a traitor, and the true traitors who are guilty are the ones who were supposed to be the great patriots and are trying to murder Jeremiah. They took Jeremiah, verse 6, and cast him into the dungeon. He was in the dungeon, let down there with cords, and in the dungeon there was no water, but just mud or mire, and he sunk in the mire. You can even imagine, and use your imagination, if you want to wonder what might that mire have been and what was a part of it. Now, when Ebed-Melech, the Ethiopian, one of the eunuchs that was in the king's house, heard that they had put Jeremiah in the dungeon, the king, then sitting in the gate of Benjamin, Ebed-Melech went forth out of the king's house and said to the king, my lord, these men have done evil in all that they have done to Jeremiah the prophet, whom they've cast into the dungeon, and he is going to die for hunger in the place where he is, because there's no more bread in the city. The king told the Ethiopian, he was a great big tall black man, probably quite heavy, because that was true when they were made eunuchs, take from hence 30 men with you, and take up Jeremiah the prophet out of the dungeon before he die. So Ebed-Melech took the men with him and went into the house of the Lord, or the king rather, under the treasury, and took out, listen to this, old cast clouts and old rotten rags. Just the thing you'd like to have around your waist or your neck. And let them down by cords into the dungeon to Jeremiah. And Ebed-Melech, the Ethiopian, said unto Jeremiah, now put these old cast clouts and rotten rags under your armholes, under the cords. And Jeremiah did so. So they drew up Jeremiah with cords and took him out of the dungeon, and Jeremiah remained in the court of the prison. Then Zedekiah the king sent and took Jeremiah the prophet unto him into the third entry that is in the house of the Eternal. And the king said to Jeremiah, now I'm going to ask you something. Tell me the truth. Hide nothing from me. Jeremiah said to Zedekiah, if I declare it unto you, will you not surely put me to death? If I tell you the truth instead of what you want to hear. And if I give you counsel, will you not hearken unto me? So Zedekiah the king sware secretly unto Jeremiah, saying, according to God's life, which was a sin, he shouldn't have done that, as the Eternal liveth, that made us this life, the Hebrew word is nephesh, this being, this life, I will not put thee to death, neither will I give thee into the hand of these men that seek your life. Then said Jeremiah unto Zedekiah, if you will assuredly go forth unto the king of Babylon's princes, then you will remain alive, and this city will not be burned with fire, and you will live and your house. But if you will not go and surrender, if you won't go out there to the king of Babylon's princes, then this city will be given into the hands of the Chaldeans, and they will burn it with fire, and you will not escape out of their hand. And Zedekiah the king said to Jeremiah, I'm afraid of the Jews that are fallen to the Chaldeans, lest they deliver me into their hand, and they mock me. But Jeremiah said, they will not deliver you. Obey, I plead with you, the voice of the Eternal, which I'm telling you, and it will be well with you, and you'll remain alive. But if you refuse to go forth, here's what God has shown me. All the women that are left in the king of Judah's house, that was his concubines and wives, shall be brought forth to the king of Babylon's princes. And those women will say, thy friends have set thee on and have prevailed against thee. Thy feet are sunk in the mire, and they are turned away back. So was Jeremiah's horrible punishment of being put down by those ropes into a slime pit stinking with who knows what, actually, again, even by that action, a little bit of a prophecy of what was really the state of the king himself, that his feet were stuck in mire, and that he was covered with filth, and that the whole nation's feet were sunk in mire, and it was covered with filth. So shall they bring out all your wives and your children to the Chaldeans, and you will not escape out of their hand, but you shall be taken by the hand of the king of Babylon, and you shall cause this city to be burned with fire. So Zedekiah said to Jeremiah, don't tell anybody about these words. You can read the rest of the chapter, and that is what happened. He didn't tell. But eventually, Nebuchadnezzar, verse 11 of chapter 39, gave charge concerning Jeremiah to Nebuzaradan, the captain of the guard, after they had captured the city. Take him and look well to him and do him no harm, but do unto him even as he shall say unto thee. And so it was that Jeremiah was given diplomatic immunity and was allowed to freely travel with Zedekiah's daughter to Egypt and escaped and perhaps took a ship of man and went to the Irish coast, where we know that there was an old ancient patriarch who had a scribe whose name was Brak, and who brought with him royal seed, as his commission had been, to plant and to build. And that's covered in my book, of course, about Europe and America in prophecy. Again, what were the motives of these men? Not a one of them volunteered. Not a one of them was a wild-eyed religious fanatic that made up some kind of a story and went to someone else to get approbation. But they had great callings of God, which were absolutely impossible to misunderstand or to in any way duplicate. Ezekiel saw the great fiery wheels that actually conveyed the one that we know of as Christ about through the universe. Isaiah had a vision of the throne of God and an angel that flew to him, or a seraphim rather, and touched his lips with fiery coal with tongs to cleanse his lips to make him a vessel for God. Ezekiel was called while he was a captive and saw these great visions. And later on, if you read about Ezekiel and what happened, I'm thinking about the 38th chapter. But anyway, Ezekiel is doing the work of God, and because his own life is to be like a reflection of what is happening in the nation, when he lay on one side and then the other so long that he got bed sores for hundreds of days at a time, and when he dug a hole in a wall and took only what he could carry on his back and was creeping out, thus will you all escape when this city is burnt with fire, and so on. And also, he is doing the work of God, and there's one chapter that says, so in that morning his wife died, and the evening he went on, he was preaching and doing the word of God. You know, I think of my own father. When we lost my mom and my father lost his wife, I know that he married later on, and that eventually ended up in a messy divorce, and I'm sorry about that. But to his very great credit, for 10 solid years, that very lonesome old gentleman did not have a wife and devoted himself to the work of God. And though my mother was no longer with him, for 10 solid years, he continued to do the work of God. If he were alive today, he would be appalled at what has happened to the work that he built up. And as I went back and looked at a little bit of his autobiography, I couldn't help but think about all of that. That perhaps somewhere along the way, there was a little bifurcation, there was a little an intersection that was taken, and infrastructure and great institutions and foundations and colleges, which seemed to be the right idea because we needed help and we needed students and we needed ministers and we needed them to be trained and be given an education and so on. That began to become a little bit of a goal. But as I look back and I realize that when I was managing, I forget now really whether it was $135 or $150 million a year. But it was such an enormous sum of money that on an occasion we were in such dire straits that I would actually have to sign a $3 million note with Wells Fargo Bank just from Friday till Monday, and by Monday the $3 million would be there so that our employees on the campus could go out and cash their checks and buy groceries. But when I look at the fact that I was only being allowed at that time out of a budget of approximately $150 million, $6 million for the media budget to be on 165 television channels and 360 radio stations, it just appalls me. Do you know how much money should have been spent on preaching the witness and the warning to the world out of 150 million? Minimum, $75 million per year. Minimum, 50% of every dime or every dollar that came in should have been spent on getting the message to the people to whom it is to go, not to building infrastructure and to having all of the other things like Quest magazine with a naked architect and a bathtub sitting on the cover. But anyway, that's past history. That's all old, long since water over the dam and under the bridge, and doesn't really matter to us, except that the policies that we are pursuing today are the policies that I believe are those that are very pleasing in God's sight. I'm not saying that the time won't come and we will not have physical facilities, and I hope and pray that eventually we can for the Tyler Headquarters Church and for our own meeting place as well as for our offices and not have to lease. But never will there be a time when at least 50% of the monies received from God's people are not spent directly on television, on those tapes going out, on the literature that is being mailed out now to 16,000 people on our mailing list.